Radio Derb is on the air. Greetings, listeners, from your presumptuously genial host, John Derbyshire, here with VDare.com's commentary on the week's news. The great 18th century satirist Jonathan Swift, the chap who wrote Gulliver's Travels, also wrote his own epitaph, as people sometimes do. "Here he lies," says the epitaph in Latin. "Ubi saeva indignatio ulterius cor lacerare nequit." Where savage indignation can no longer lacerate his heart. I am nothing like as much of a misanthrope as Swift, thank goodness. As Radio Derb listeners well know, I cultivate geniality. Still, I'm not a total stranger to savage indignation. There are times, blessedly few and far between, but there are times when I boil and seethe with righteous anger at the stupidity and cruelty of my fellow human beings. This is one of those times. Savage indignation, yes. That was my reaction to the sentencing last Friday of Gregory McMichael, his son Travis, and their neighbour, Roddy Bryan, in the show trial over the death of Armaud Arbery 2 years ago. The two McMichaels were both sentenced to life in prison with no possibility of parole. Brian will be eligible for parole, but only after he serves the mandatory minimum of 30 years in prison. He's 52 years old, so good luck there, guy. These were three honest, hard-working citizens, none of whom had any criminal record. Both of the McMichaels had in fact served in law enforcement. Their intentions in confronting Arbery were plain: to defend their neighbourhood against a likely thief who, whether or not they knew it, did have a criminal record. Travis McMichael shot Arbery in plain self-defence when Arbery was trying to wrestle away his gun. Gregory McMichael didn't shoot anybody. He was trying to call the police. Roddy Bryan wasn't even armed. Now their lives have been brutally destroyed, along with the lives of Mrs. McMichael, who has cancer, her daughter, Travis's 5-year-old son, and Roddy Bryan's fiancée and their two children. I can't think of any other way to see this monstrous act of state cruelty other than the way I saw it when the trial was underway back in October, as a ritual sacrifice to the dark gods revered in our weird, sick state religion of white self-hatred. Quote from me back then, following a reference to the Aztecs. Edited quote: "When we offer up our sacrifices, we stage a show trial modelled on the actual trials that used to be conducted before our justice system was taken over by ideological fanatics. The verdict is, of course, a foregone conclusion. Then we lock up our sacrificial victim for decades in a place of humiliation and despair, parted forever from his home, his family, and his work. This is far more cruel than anything the Aztecs would have contemplated. End quote. The McMichaels and Roddy Bryan were sentenced for being white. It couldn't be more obvious. Does anyone think that sentences like this would have been handed down if they had been black petty criminals and Armaud Arbery a white mechanic? The spectacle is made even uglier by the sight of the usual hyenas hovering around. Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton showed up at the trial, and a posse of rifle-toting black anarchists stood watch outside the courthouse. Armaud Arbery's mother was dabbing her eyes as she told us what a lovely person her son was. Apparently, having forgotten that she was so scared of him, she'd called the cops at least once. His father Marcus showed up, although whether he had played any part in raising Armaud, we have not been told. Who cares? The ghetto lottery is the prize now. Cash from civil lawsuits. Benjamin Crump is involved somehow. Looking forward to his share, no doubt. For this, half a dozen white lives have been destroyed. Not the least depressing thing about this case is that such a monstrous injustice has been protested by nobody at all of any prominence in the media or politics. Tucker Carlson, to the best of my knowledge, has not mentioned it. Greg Gutfeld seems to have approved the verdict. Someone told me Laura Ingraham has expressed approval too, although I can't find an online link, and I would be glad to know it's not true. Republican op-ed writers, Congress critters and ex-presidents. Out here on the dissident right, we have been protesting. Most eloquently, Jared Taylor here at VDare.com, November 26th and January 8th. Also, our correspondent Federale on November 26th. And, of course, your genial host myself on October 22nd, November 19th, November 26th and December 10th. An email correspondent offers the opinion, which I think is correct, that we now have four different legal systems. 1. White on black crime. For these crimes, mob justice, just short of lynching, but with the optics of a fair trial. 2. White on white crime. For these, standard American jurisprudence. 3. Black on white crime. Standard American jurisprudence again, but with reduced severity, given that the root cause is systemic racism, not any depravity on the part of the defendant. 4. Black on black crime. This is discouraged, but it's not investigated or prosecuted too vigorously, except in the most egregious of cases. Nobody much cares what blacks do to each other. And there is no money to be made from these crimes by Al Sharpton or Benjamin Crump. I thought perhaps talking about this might soothe my savage indignation, but no, it's still lacerating my heart. I shall therefore stop here, except just in the spirit of a public service announcement, just to repeat the advice that I offered back in November. Back there I said, quote, The video shot by William Bryan, which shows Travis McMichael and Arbery struggling for Travis's shotgun, was not known about until the defendants voluntarily gave it to the authorities, on the assumption that it would help prove Travis was acting in self-defense. End quote. The lesson to be drawn, listeners, is, once again, if you are white and you're being investigated by public authorities and there is a dead black person to be accounted for, do not cooperate in any way with the investigation. In particular, don't offer them anything that you think might help your case. They will just find a way to use it against you. Joe Biden did a truly astonishing thing this week. He made Mitch McConnell look good. It happened thus. On Tuesday in Atlanta, Biden gave a speech at the Atlanta University Center about voting rights. The center is in a part of Atlanta with a lot of historically black colleges. You can read a transcript of the speech at the White House website. The gist of the speech was that if Congress doesn't pass legislation to impose federal rules on voting, rules that loosen up voting procedures even more than they were loosened up in 2020 to make sure Donald Trump didn't get elected, if Congress didn't legislate thus, George Wallace would rise from the grave and stand in the schoolhouse door. There'd be an end of civil rights, and black Americans would be back where they were in 1952, if not 1852. I've been struggling to find an adjective to describe the speech. To call it hyperbolic would be to understate the matter. So it would in fact be an example of litotes, which, as every rhetorician knows, is the opposite of hyperbole. The most apt adjective for Biden's speech is, I think, unhinged. Well, the following day, Wednesday, Mitch McConnell made a speech in the US Senate about Biden's speech. You can read the transcript of that at McConnell's Senate website, mcconnell.senate.gov. The usually mild-mannered McConnell took Biden to pieces. Sample, quote, "A president shouting that 52 senators and millions of Americans are racist unless he gets whatever he wants is proving exactly why the framers built the Senate to check his power. This whole display is the best possible argument for preserving the Senate rules that extend deliberation, force bipartisan compromise, and let cooler heads prevail. Nothing proves it better than this episode. It offers a perfect case study in why Senator Biden was right about the filibuster and President Biden is wrong." End quote. I'm no fan of Mitch McConnell. He's been in the Senate for 37 years. He's been GOP leader in the Senate for 6 years, without much to show for it. There are some plain and obvious things that need doing at the federal level, most notably from the point of view of this website, things concerning immigration and citizenship. McConnell hasn't stirred himself to advance any of those things. We live in wild times, though, with some wild people in power planning wild things, and a president who supports them, and wild, destructive mobs to act as their enforcers. At such times, there is something to be said for the old, complacent, rule-governed, transactional model of legislative power. That model doesn't get much done, but, like ballast in a ship, it may stop the thing capsizing. So, yes, McConnell is a go-along, get-along, milquetoast, non-confrontational seat warmer who is never going to do anything to challenge birthright citizenship or end our imperial adventures or ban public sector unions. Still, set right up against Crazy Joe like that, McConnell sounds like Pericles by comparison. Well done there, Mitch. When first settling into this country, I naively assumed that Supreme Court justices were chosen for being the wisest and most learned of all our multitude of legal scholars. That was naive. I now understand what I think Americans at large all understand, that wisdom and learning are very minor factors, if they are even factors at all, in the selection of Supreme Court justices. These justices are not chosen for their wisdom or learning. They are chosen for political acceptability. We got two nice illustrations of this on Friday last week in debates over the constitutionality of the OSHA mandate requiring all employers of at least 100 people to enforce vaccinations or regular testing. Well, perhaps not really two illustrations, maybe one and a half. The half was Justice Stephen Breyer claiming that there were actual, quote, 750 million new cases yesterday, end quote. The population of the USA last Thursday was in fact 332 million and change, according to the Bureau of the Census Population Clock. Well, look, obviously, Justice Breyer meant to say 750,000. That million was a slip of the tongue, of the kind that we all make. Although people who are as old as Justice Breyer, he's 83, make a lot more of them than the average. That's why I've only given him half a demerit. I might have given him a totally free pass, except that Justice Breyer also claimed, when working the numbers, that vaccines and masks would prevent 100% of coronavirus infections. Not even the most fanatical proponents of masks and vaccines claim that. That is just ignorance. The real depths of dumbassery, however, were plumbed by Justice Sotomayor. Sample question from her, addressed to an attorney arguing against the mandate. Quote, why is a human being not like a machine if it's spewing a virus? Blood-borne viruses, end quote. In exactly what respects human beings are like machines has been vexing metaphysicians at least since the time of Descartes, 400 years ago. 100 years after that, in 1747, the French philosopher Julien Offre de la Mettrie published his book L'Homme Machine, Man the Machine, which you can now read for free with a parallel text English translation at the Gutenberg website. I seriously doubt that Justice Sotomayor had metaphysics on her mind. I would be surprised, in fact, to learn that she has ever heard of Descartes, let alone Offre de la Mettrie. She is one seriously dumb broad, even by Supreme Court standards. She demonstrated that in this same hearing by saying that, quote, "We have over 100,000 children, which we've never had before, in serious condition and many on ventilators," end quote. The actual number of children hospitalised with COVID, as Justice Sotomayor was speaking, was less than 5,000. I don't know where she got that 100,000 from. Most likely she just made it up. The world's most primitive people, hunter-gatherers in the Amazon jungle or the New Guinea highlands, are said to have words in their languages only for the numbers 1, 2 and 3. Any quantity above that is covered by a word meaning many. So they count 1, 2, 3, many. Innumerate people in civilized countries are something like that. They can count way past 3, of course. They can count to 100 or 1,000. Still, in their mental landscape, anything more than a few dozen is just many. 5,000, 100,000, 1,000,000. It's all the same, isn't it? I have always known Justice Sotomayor is dumb, but I didn't appreciate just how dumb she is until I read Helen Andrews' book, Boomers, which came out last year. The book's subtitle is The Men and Women Who Promised Freedom and Delivered Disaster. So you can see the angle that Ms. Andrews is approaching her subject from. She honours 6 boomers with a chapter each of their own, and Justice Sotomayor is one of the 6. The chapter on Justice Sotomayor is 26 pages long, and it is withering. Sotomayor is, Helen Andrews tells us with a wealth of supporting quotes and instances, she is a narcissist, a bully, and intellectually mediocre. That last defect is not unusual on the Supreme Court. Helen Andrews reminds us that Earl Warren, who was Chief Justice of the Supreme Court from 1953 to 1969, was, quote from her, "as dumb as a post," end quote. That's not an isolated opinion. Andrews supplies supporting quotes from Warren's colleagues and legal peers. Note those dates when Warren was Chief Justice. Most of the 50s and all of the 60s. The years when judicial activism, legislating from the bench, that is, found its legs and started running. As Helen Andrews writes, quote, "Earl Warren changed America more than any single human being in the second half of the 20th century. The decisions of the Warren Court reshaped America dramatically," end quote. All that from a guy who Felix Frankfurter referred to as that dumb Swede. In fact, Earl Warren was only half Swedish. The other half was Norwegian. Nobody who knew him seems to have disputed the dumb, though. That's how our highest court went from interpreting the law to making the law. Justice Sotomayor is fine with it. Wisdom? Only in her own opinion. Learning? Nah. But look, she's female and a Puerto Rican. Just what the Supreme Court needs. Dumb people making dumb laws. But wait, isn't that what Congress is for? A little short of 10 years ago, the precise anniversary is April 5th, 10 years ago I published a column titled The Talk, Non-Black Version, at Tacky's Magazine. That was in the panic that followed George Zimmerman shooting Trayvon Martin in Florida. Black journalists had been publishing weepy articles about how they had to give the talk to their kids, to warn them about the white supremacist assassins who lurk around every corner in the USA. I pushed back with a talk that non-black citizens might give to their kids, to warn them about black crime and antisocial behaviour. I thought I should include some cautions about political corruption, which you get much more of when blacks hold power. So, in my numbered list of advice items, there were the following. Item 10F. Do not settle in a district or municipality run by black politicians. Item 10G. Before voting for a black politician, scrutinise his or her character much more carefully than you would a white. Well, the voters of New York City should have paid attention. I have passed some comments in previous podcasts about New York City's new mayor, Eric Adams, who is black. My earliest comments back in October, when the election was underway, were not enthusiastic. But, willing to give a new guy a chance, I left open the possibility that he might work out okay. Then, in mid-December, when Adams had got elected and was announcing his first picks for senior executives in his administration, I was still trying to be charitable. I noted that, while both picks announced to that point were black, neither was obviously crazy. Now, I'm thinking I was too charitable. One of those December picks, David Banks for school's chancellor, has a brother named Philip. Adams has named Philip Banks as his deputy mayor of public safety, notwithstanding Banks was named by the feds as an unindicted co-conspirator in a big corruption case when he was chief of the New York City Police Department. Then, once settled into office on January 1st, Mayor Adams named his own brother, Bernard, a retired city police sergeant, as a deputy city police commissioner on an annual salary of $240,000. When people protested that this was nepotism, His Honor's response was that Bernard, quote, will be in charge of my security, which is extremely important to me, at a time when we see an increase in white supremacy and hate crimes. End quote. For some reason, that didn't still the protests, so the mayor backed down some. Bernard would, he said, be given a slightly lesser post, as executive director of mayoral security, on an annual salary of only $210,000. And we're not even 1 month into Adams' mayoralty yet. I'm going to throw charity to the winds and predict that Eric Adams' mayoralty will be a corrupt-a-palooza. In the previous segment, I mentioned my April 2012 column titled The Talk, Non-Black Version. I made particular mention of items 10F and 10G in my list of prescriptions concerning black political corruption. Right after those two items in my list, there came, of course, item 10H. Item 10H. Do not act the Good Samaritan to blacks in apparent distress, e.g. on the highway. Finding examples to illustrate that presented no problem at all. The news outlets are full of them. The great Colin Flaherty, who we lost forever this week, provided a sheaf of them. Well, here's another from this week's news. Around 8:30 Wednesday morning this week, when it was really seriously cold, a 58-year-old white man was walking along Fifth Avenue in Midtown Manhattan when he saw a homeless black guy lying curled up, apparently asleep, on the sidewalk, with nothing covering him. The white man took off his own coat and gently draped it over the other. Whereupon, the black man grabbed him, pulled him down, and took the wallet from his back pocket. The Good Samaritan tried to get his wallet back, but the black guy punched him, knocked him down, kicked him, and ran off. You can see the whole thing on surveillance video at the New York Post website. The perp was soon caught. We now know that he is 25-year-old Xavier Israel. It turns out he is a particular menace to Good Samaritans. Quote from the New York Post, January 15th, quote, on January 8th, he allegedly attacked a 49-year-old woman on 5th Avenue and East 84th Street after she saw him sleeping on the ground and tried to help. End quote. That January 8th incident was just a few days after, on January 2nd, he had been arrested for assaulting a man and a woman in Central Park. I don't know if the Central Park couple were trying to help him. If they were, and they were non-black, and if the January 8th Good Samaritan lady was non-black too, that would make Xavier Israel an item 10H trifecta. For both of those earlier incidents, Israel had been given a desk appearance ticket and set free. For the one this Wednesday, though, where he assaulted and robbed the 58-year-old white male Good Samaritan who'd tried to give him his coat, for that one, prosecutors have ordered that Israel be held on $25,000 bail. That has stirred angry protests from Brian Kennedy, Israel's lawyer. It goes totally against the memo issued by just-elected Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg, as described by Radio Derb last week. D.A. Bragg, whose campaign was financed by George Soros, wants detention only for homicide and a small handful of other serious crimes. Second-degree robbery, which is what Xavier Israel is charged with, is not serious enough. So Israel should be turned loose, argues this Brian Kennedy, his attorney. Actual quote from him, referring to D.A. Bragg's memo. If you're going to make that kind of statement in the memo, then you should abide by it. They didn't. They argued for bail when he should have been presumptuously released. End quote. And yes, I double-checked that. He really did say presumptuously. At any rate, according to the Post. I hope I won't be thought too presumptuous if I claim that the Talk non-black version is holding up pretty well coming up to its 10th birthday. And now, our closing miscellany of brief items. Imprimis. Having praised Mitch McConnell there, looking up the dates that he has served in office, I happen to notice that his 80th birthday is coming up on the 20th of next month. It's way early to wish Mitch happy birthday, but I do anyway. Now I'm going to take the shine off that by grumbling that the guy is way too old to be in charge of the Senate GOP. What on earth has happened here? We are ruled by geezers. Joe Biden, 79. Nancy Pelosi, 81. There's talk of Donald Trump running against Hillary Clinton in 2024, when he'll be 78 and she'll be 77. McConnell's opposite number, Chuck Schumer, at 71, is a spring chicken. Human beings are very variable, of course, but we really shouldn't take chances like this with the governance of our country. In the great majority of cases, the balance between youthful energy and elderly wisdom is at its optimum between ages 45 and 65. I'm going to make a personal vow not to vote for anyone in the most senior offices, that is, president, vice president, senator, governor, who is outside that age range. Item. In his Tuesday speech, the president dropped one of his habitual teasers about how, as a young man, he had been involved in the civil rights movement. Quote from the White House transcript. I did not walk in the shoes of generations of students who walked these grounds, but I walked other grounds. Because I'm so damn old, I was there as well. You think I'm kidding, man? It seems like yesterday, the first time I got arrested. Anyway. End quote. I've never seen any evidence that Biden was active in the civil rights movement, or that he got arrested. My guess is, however, that he's been telling these tales for so long, he believes them. There is a precedent here. Britain's monarch through the 1820s was George IV, one of the worst monarchs ever. Vain, selfish, frivolous, and irresponsible. As the Victorian ditty went, George I was always reckoned vile, but viler George II. And what mortal ever heard any good of George III? When to heaven the IV ascended, God be praised, the Georges ended. The 20th century actually turned up two more Georges, so the Victorians were being over-optimistic there. Well, in his later years, George IV got it fixed in his mind that he had played a glorious part in the Battle of Waterloo, leading his own regiment of cavalry down a strategic hill towards the enemy. In fact, he had been nowhere near Waterloo. Still, at a banquet where the Duke of Wellington was present, the king boasted of this imaginary feat and appealed to the duke to support his story. Was it not a steep hill he had charged down? The duke famously replied, "Very steep, Your Majesty." Item. Concerning the Census Bureau's population clock, which I mentioned back there, I take its numbers with a large helping of salt. Do they include the tens of thousands of illegal aliens the Biden administration has been sluicing in? I'm sure they don't. I am also puzzled to know why our population, as recorded there, has not yet reached a third of a billion. On the numbers for births and deaths presented there, in fact, I calculate the population counter will reach 333,333,333 round about 6:14 a.m. on March 7th next year. Here's a funny thing, though. In my monthly diary for October 2016, I did exactly the same calculation, using the same population clock from the Census Bureau. For the date when our population would hit a third of a billion, I came up with sometime in the late evening of January 25th, 2020. So, we are way overdue, nearly 2 years overdue, for that third of a billion mark, with a year still to go, according to today's calculation. When I did that calculation back in 2016, the rate of increase, that is births minus deaths plus net immigration, was shown as one person every 12 seconds. On the current clock, it's shown as one person every 40 seconds. That's a big slowdown, which I guess accounts for us being overdue on reaching a third of a billion. That's assuming you believe the Census Bureau's numbers. Do I believe them? Well, I'd like to see an audit. Item. Another footnote to the main commentary. At one of my encounters with the late Colin Flaherty, I impressed him by knowing the Irish spelling of his name. In case you don't know, Irish spelling is even more eccentric and illogical than English spelling. Flaherty is spelt F-L-A-I-T-H-B-H-E-A-R-T-A-I-G-H. With Colin's passing, there is now one less person in the world who knows that. Item. In my Christmas Eve podcast, I looked forward with nervous anticipation to the Christmas Day launch of the James Webb Space Telescope. Nervous because this is an immensely complicated contraption, and there were many things that might have gone wrong. Nothing did, and the James Webb is now unfolded, intact, and well on its way to its stationary point a million miles from Earth, where, after a few months of tests and calibrations, observations will commence later this year. We are not out of the woods yet. There are still things that could go wrong. But hearty congratulations to NASA and their collaborators for getting this wonderful instrument this far in safety. Fingers crossed for the remainder of the mission. That's all for this week, ladies and gents. Thank you for your time and attention, and a very happy and relaxing Martin Luther King Day to you. One of the minor pleasures of living in England in the 70s and 80s was Radio 4, a BBC channel aimed at thoughtful, educated, middle-class types like your genial host. Along with serious stuff, plays, political commentary and so on, they had programmes that were fun, in a genteel kind of way. These were quiz programmes of various kinds, none of them very serious. The guests, usually celebrities of the minor sort. One of these shows was titled, quote, unquote. It was all built around quotations. The chairman would offer a quotation and challenge the panel to say who or what was being quoted. Then participants would branch off with similar quotes or contrary quotes or anecdotes about whoever said it, and so on. My more bohemian friends scoffed at it as insufferably bourgeois, and even some non-bohemians thought it dull. I liked it, though, when I had nothing better to do. It must have had some decent audience share. It ran for 46 years with the same chairman, who was also the chap who'd thought it up in the first place, name of Nigel Rees. Some of the shows have been preserved on the BBC Sounds website if you'd like to form your own opinion. Rees wound up the show at the end of last year because of, yes, wokeness. The BBC is very woke, and he was finding it unbearably oppressive. The suits wanted him to have a diverse panel of guests, with their suitability to the show, as judged by Mr. Rees, secondary. One of the last straws was the suit's response when Rees had wanted to include some lines from Noel Coward's song Mad Dogs and Englishmen. He wanted to include the lines, "In Bengal, to move at all is seldom, if ever, done." That, said the suits, wouldn't do because it, quote, reflected colonial attitudes, end quote. Shortly afterwards, Rees quit and the show came off the air. Well, fie on the BBC and fie on all wokeness. Here is the second half of Mad Dogs and Englishmen, where those shamefully colonial lines may be heard, sung here by Noel Coward himself. There will be more from Radio Derb next week.
Mad dogs and Englishmen go out in the midday sun. The toughest Burmese bandit can never understand it. In Rangoon, the heat of noon is just what the natives shun. They put the Scotch or rye down and lie down. In a jungle town where the sun beats down to the rage of man and beast, the English garb of the English Saab merely gets a bit more creased. In Bangkok, at 12 o'clock, they foam at the mouth and run. But mad dogs and Englishmen go out in the midday sun. Mad dogs and Englishmen go out in the midday sun. The smallest Malay rabbit deplores this foolish habit. In Hong Kong, they strike a gong and fire off a noonday gun to reprimand each inmate who's in late. In the mangrove swamps by the python rumps, there is peace from 12 to 2. Even caribous lie around and snooze, for there's nothing else to do. In Bengal, to move at all is seldom, if ever, done. But mad dogs and Englishmen go out in the midday, 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 out in the midday sun.